tried to get Opal to actually buy the kids over the railway station.
Should be a new urban walk for us soon. From the house to
the house. Yeah, it's actually so far from me.
Then call it the walk-in butterfly.
Are you recording there?
And it's like gaps out the old railway station.
Yeah.
Are
we? Is this the same for the British Rail?
Standard gauge.
That's
good.
Thank you. Jogging in a moment. Did you see the birds?
Yeah.
Was that mental?
They were
trying
to find a cacophony.
They were. That was
a cacophony.
I didn't hear anything. I thought that was quite interesting.
No. I had a little chat with the guy with the drum.
Did you? Did you interrupt him in his play?
No, when he was finished. Oh. I said I really enjoyed that.
Oh.
I said I didn't really enjoy that. It's certainly natural.
So what was he saying about... What, did you get a deep chat about why they do it?
No, it's not a chat, but I just asked him that he was doing it. It's a bit like if he's ignoring him.
Oh.
How can you ignore somebody who thinks it's such an interesting matter?
Yeah. I just loved the way the birds sort of got in on the act.
That was a really fortunate accident.
Uh-huh.
Do you think that that's a funny thing about seagulls, isn't it? Most of them are.
There's a gun. On my travels, I spotted a gun. Don't put your fingerprints on it! I'd like to record, make it known, Darry.
Darry
has a gun.
Yeah. I like that. It's a really? Nice piece. It's got a good weight to it.
Crikey, that's quite heavy, isn't it? Is that real?
Yeah. I spotted it earlier and asked Ian what it was. It's
You're
a BB gun.
Now.
Oh, what's
I
that?
I thought it was a real gun. But
what's a BB gun?
She's little steel pellets.
That's got to be dangerous.
Yeah, you can kill people if you really go to their eyes or something. Maybe.
Okay. Do you think it's got one in it?
I tried it. It didn't.
It's the answer. I'll ring.
No.
£40.
No, I don't want one. I could always sell it on eBay or take it down to the eBay shop in Stockbridge.
Yeah.
Oh, can I have a track? Can I have a track? I think I'm ready for it now.
I don't think
Oh, I'm quite frightened. Oh, well done. Oh.
So you just load it in.
You're doing random noises. It's uncalled for. It's uncalled for random noises. Take some seagulls out. Do you not think those guys have come in at your random intervals?
Who? There's a pen.
Sorry, tell me a bit quite entertaining story about his brother.
No.
The way we walk after Stand By Me and all.
Wild Strawberries.
Oops.
There you go, Jen.
Quite nice.
Abandoned building site and a very close in Dundee. In Newcastle, what are we doing in Newcastle? It was fantastic. Oh, we played a deserted and abandoned community center and library in Easter House. Oh, I'm sorry, that's Easter House. Then in Newcastle, we played a bridge that just ran off and stopped in the middle of nowhere. Underpass, somewhat similar to this, but with a very, very different kind of feel to it. And then in Cumbernauld, we played in the strange stairwells and corridors of what many people apparently think is the ugliest building in Britain, but which is a very interesting building in any case. And here we are tonight playing here, and in the site we'll be taking you to once I've finished talking to you for a second. Shadow spaces are of intense interest to psychogeographers of either of the two historical stripes that I'm really interested in. One of these goes back to the early 1950s when Guy Debord coined the word in any of its contemporary uses. He's one of the coiners of the word in any of its contemporary uses. He was, at the time, a member of the Lettrists, an avant-garde sort of splinter in Paris. One of the fallouts of the sort of devolving surrealist involvement. And in fact, he wasn't to stay a Lettrist very long. He morphed from just a Lettrist into the Lettrist International, and then he became a situationist in rapid order. Not in rapid order. There were a number of steps in there. Along the way, however, he enunciated his interest in something he called psychogeography, which was posited to be the study of the relationship of the environment to human beings and human beings to the environment. And it was a relationship that he proposed to study in a variety of ways, but the technique that he was most interested in and that he devoted most attention to was what he called a derive, or drift, which was a way, he felt, allowing the urban environment, the city, to speak to him or to speak to people. Drifts have become really kind of popular lately, but I think that one of the things that has been lost as they become popular is the kind of rigor they really demand. One of the things that's characteristic of all the places that we visited in these past 2 weeks is that they've been vacated of the intentions that brought them into being. This is no longer an active rail site. And with that intention withdrawn and none rushing in to fill that void, the space is, as it were, unintentioned, intentionless, agendaless. It's an open space, a free space, and a space that, in fact, can be used, as we've used it tonight, and that has the power to evoke the kinds of sounds that you heard from our musicians tonight. This lack of agenda, this lack of intention, is what you have to achieve if you're going to drift in any kind of reasonable way. De Boer felt that the city was compounded of islands of attraction that he called unities of ambience. These were places with a peculiarly powerful urban character that drew you in, that attracted you, and of spaces that completely lack this character, and those would repulse you. And he felt that you could be pulled by the city and pushed by the city if you let yourself. And to let yourself be pushed and pulled by the city, you had to free yourself of your need to get someplace, of your need to go there and have an agenda and a goal that will determine precisely, you know, where you're going to go. I'm going to go there, therefore I have to walk here, I have to walk there. The city can't pull you and push you under those circumstances. So what you have to do is you have to empty yourself of intention, just as these spaces have been emptied of intention. And that's not easy to do. I don't know how many of you have tried it, but it's harder than you think. And even if you begin and you get going, it's surprising how readily, ooh, I forgot, I have to, bang, and that comes in, and suddenly you're off the drift and moving someplace entirely different. De Boer mapped these places in groups of 3, 4, 5, 6. He wanted to drift together with other people to ensure the objectivity, as he called it, the objectivity of these pushes and pulls. He felt that if you were just by yourself, okay, maybe idiosyncratic subjectivities could also enter into it and interfere with the resonance of the of these spaces. But if you were drifting together, those would somehow cancel each other out. So 3 or 4 or 5 people drifting together would ensure you of being able to find those unities of ambience with that particularly powerful, erratic quality that he felt was so important. The other aspect of that drifting together was that he was able to objectify what he felt was a kind of desire matrix that operated in the city. And that if you drifted together in these ways and found these places, you could reveal the city as a terrain of passion. He mapped these. He cut little sections of maps out that were these unities of ambience, and he pasted them down, connecting them with red arrows that indicated the pushes and the pulls. He made 2 of these maps. In 56, he made Discourse on Love, and in 57, with Asger Jorn, he made The Naked City. And these maps have gone on to have a really powerful career. They've magnetized people's attention in ways that I don't think he could possibly have imagined. I think it's important to note that the Situationists were never numerous. There were just handfuls of them. And that by the time the early 70s came around, they were gone. Situationism is not a word that De Boer would allow to be spoken in his presence. The Situationists stopped being Situationists in the early 70s. And they were forgotten for about 20 years. With the growing popularity and importance of his book, The Society of the Spectacle, his work became increasingly translated, and with these translations, people began to read these early papers that he wrote, and one of the things they discovered among them was the idea of the drift, was the idea of psychogeography. And starting in the early 90s, these ideas gained a lot of currency and became important strand in contemporary thinking about the environment, but a real one nonetheless. So there's that strand of psychogeography. At the same time that De Boer was carrying out his work, an urban planner named Kevin Lynch was doing very, very dissimilar, but very, very related work in Boston, Massachusetts. The thing that connects Lynch and De Boer in the beginning is the fact that they're motivated by a powerful fear, distaste, and dislike of the urban planning that was being carried out in their environments in the 50s. De Boer particularly concerned with Paris, and Lynch in the beginning particularly concerned with Boston, but also with other American cities. Lynch was driven to ask himself how it was that people understood their cities. How did they perceive their cities? How did they know about their cities? How did they feel toward their cities? This is a very DeBoardian kind of question in a way. But he's an MIT planner. He's at an engineering school, and instead of drifting, he administered questionnaires. He walked people through the city and tape recorded their remarks about the environment. He asked them to identify photos. He asked them to make sketch maps of their environment. He asked them to create lists of places they liked and disliked. He asked them to give directions from one place to the other. And out of all these materials, he was able to pull a series of maps that spoke to the image of, in the beginning, Boston, and then he replicated this work in Jersey City and later in Los Angeles. And in 1960, he publishes The Image of the City. The Image of the City is one of these crazy books. It's a planning book, but it's been in print continuously since 1960, and it's been read by millions of people. Again, though, despite that, the kind of work that he was engaged in caught fire only in a very few strange places. One of them was in a psychologist named David Stay. David Stay came to Clark University, which had a very, very well-known and important geography program, and this geography program hired David Stay. And he began teaching a course in the environment and psychology. And pretty soon, the students called it psychogeography, and the second year that he taught it, it was officially called psychogeography. And psychogeography became a discipline in geography for, it had a run of 6, 7, 8 years. And carried out a lot of work in human perception of the environment. People doing investigations of how ordinary citizens saw their cities in Venezuela and Mexico and the Caribbean islands, throughout American cities, numerous European cities, Jerusalem. Again, this tradition sort of died away. It certainly died away in geography. A lot of the people who were involved in it went off to found or to work in environmental psychology programs. And in fact, most of what was psychogeography in the 60s and late 60s and 70s has become environmental psychology today, where I feel it's lost most of its environment. It's held on to its psychology, but it's lost its environment. Again, it died. And it was revived once again only on the tales of Du Bois's psychogeography. Du Bois's psychogeography begins to be popular in the 90s. And people go, whoa, psychogeography? That's not some crazy thing done in Paris. That's the stuff done by these geographers and psychologists. And the Du Boisian people are like, what are you talking about? Psychogeography is... So there was this sort of mutual door opening, and these two traditions have really fruitfully supported each other in their movement toward whatever's going on today, whatever that might be.